One April day, almost 30 years ago in Illinois, a ballistics expert took the stand in the Winnebago County Courthouse, prepared to deliver the damning testimony that would help prosecutors win a conviction in a fatal robbery. It was 1994. Daniel Gunnell worked in the state crime lab as a firearm tool mark examiner, meaning his specialty was connecting shell casings to the guns that fired them. Gunnell didn't bring any photographs. In fact, he didn't take any, to show the jury what he had concluded with full confidence, that the 9mm Taurus used to kill 22-year-old Andy Asher in Rockford was the gun police said they found in the home of the defendant, Patrick Pursley. Gunnell was so confident in his findings that he told the jury the bullet casings from the crime scene could only have come from the 9mm Taurus entered into evidence, quote, to the exclusion of all other firearms in the world.
And so, of course, it's not true.
Gunnell arrived at his conclusion by examining the scratches and dents on bullets and shell casings to find markings that are unique to a specific weapon. He explained that as a bullet travels through the barrel, it picks up the scratches and marks in the barrel, and these markings are visible under a microscope. Such marks, Gunnell continued, are so unique to a gun that it's as good as a fingerprint. Patrick Pursley, who sat at the defense table while Gunnell testified for the prosecution, says Gunnell's testimony was the linchpin for his conviction. He said that was because detectives had no physical evidence connecting him to Asher's killing.
That's what they touted in the Watson papers. That was, they literally put in the newspaper, the gospel according to Gunnell.
Patrick's defense team also presented their own ballistics expert. And unlike Gunnell, he took photos and told the jury he believed the shell casings from the crime scene did not match the test rounds fired from the gun police recovered. But Patrick's expert didn't have the same qualifications as Gunnell, and he crumbled under pressure on the stand.
You know, when they made the insinuation that my expert was doing this for money, he just started breathing on the mic. He just started breathing heavily.
At trial, Patrick's defense team provided an alibi for the night in question. The night Andy Asher was killed, on April 2nd, 1993, they said Patrick was at home with his girlfriend, Samantha Crabtree, and Patrick's son. The jury, however, convicted Patrick of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison. The trial judge called him a menace to society, given his vast prior criminal record. Patrick embarked on a decades-long journey trying to prove his innocence, that he did not commit murder. He taught himself law and filed his own appeals for more than a decade. He earned some crucial victories along the way, including persuading Illinois lawmakers to pass the legislation needed to retest the evidence in his case, which eventually led to a second trial 23 years later. It would appear as though the very evidence that had put him in prison was now being disputed. But beyond ballistics, the case also raised some questions about how Rockford police investigated the case after allegations of a confession from a detective surfaced, a confession that alleged they had tampered with evidence. To this day, Patrick has maintained that he did not kill Andy Asher, but the investigators who put forth their case against him say not so fast. After all was said and done, would Patrick succeed in proving his innocence? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 158. Most days I work from home, and being at home so often makes me feel extremely unmotivated to work out. But thankfully, working out with my Peloton bike makes it really hard for me to make excuses. Like, I don't have time. Well, they've got 20-minute classes. Or, I'm too tired. Try a low-impact ride. I got my Peloton bike shortly after I had my daughter. I felt like I was so out of shape, and frankly, I just needed an escape every day. Now I feel like some of the instructors are actually my friends. Working out with Peloton is so much more than just riding a bike. It's an experience where the instructors motivate you and make it fun. I love taking classes with intervals and with weights involved, and my favorite instructor is Allie Love. Peloton has the best instructors with the best playlists. Whether you're in the mood for some hip-hop, pop, or country, the Peloton bike has the right music to keep you entertained and motivated all year long. Peloton has classes for every level, and as you progress, choose from a wide range of cycling classes that meet your level and keep you challenged every time you clip in. And it isn't just game-changing cardio. Add a strength class to your ride like I do, or combine cardio and strength in one workout with bike boot camp to get a total body fitness experience. And you can get just one subscription for your whole family. Their all-access membership is more like a family plan for no additional cost. Get started on your Peloton journey. Go to onepeloton.com to learn more. That's onepeloton.com. If you're listening to this podcast, chances are you love true crime and mysteries too, which is why you'll want to check out June's Journey, a hidden object murder mystery game you can play on your phone. In the game, you're June Parker, and you're investigating the mysterious death of your sister and her husband. Police say it was a murder-suicide, but is that what really happened? Not only does June's Journey have a compelling storyline, but it's also really fun to play. You can unlock clues by finding hidden objects and talking to various characters. I'm pretty new at the game still, but I've already uncovered some really cool clues into what happened, including a mysterious photo of the crime scene. This game is great to play when you're looking to kill some time or just looking to relax and to lose yourself in a good mystery. It's actually really hard to put down. June's Journey is free to download on your phone or tablet, and there are new chapters every week. Join the more than 30 million fans and unleash your inner detective. Download June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Around 10 p.m. on April 2nd, 1993, 22-year-old Andy Asher and his girlfriend, Becky, were sitting in a parked car in front of the apartment building where Becky's brother lived. Suddenly, a masked gunman opened the driver's side door where Andy was sitting and demanded money. The gunman refused the $60 Becky handed to him, and as she reached into her purse to look for more money, she said she heard two pops and then saw Andy slumping forward in his seat. The gunman ran away, and Becky ran to her brother's apartment to call the police. She said the gunman, whom she described as black, was wearing a blue ski mask, dark clothing, and a hoodie with a zipper. When he was killed, Andy was working for the city of Rockford, repairing fire department trucks. Patrick Pursley, who was 27 at the time, had already been locked up three times for burglary and marijuana possession. He moved to Rockford when he was 17. To live with the woman with whom he had his first son. Before he became a suspect in Andy Asher's homicide, Patrick said he had decided to stay out of trouble. He no longer was a member of the Gangster Disciples and had recently learned he had a daughter with another woman who had given up the child. He got custody of her and had his son for the summer.
So I'm actually like saying to myself, like, you know, I'm done. I got to be done with the streets. I got to be done. I have to somehow, you know, create a future for my children.
2 months after Andy's killing, police began to zero in on Patrick as a suspect. They received a Crime Stoppers tip, for which they provided a $2,650 reward by a man claiming Patrick had confessed to Andy's murder. Patrick was already well known to Rockford police.
I was a mouthy guy. You know, when I was gang banger, whatever, you know, so actually detectives, you know, that's involved in this case, I had previous, you know, I've been sent to prison by.
After the Crime Stoppers tip, police began surveilling the home where Patrick lived with his girlfriend, Samantha. Patrick said he had no idea police considered him a suspect in Andy's death. He found that out later on TV.
They pulled up on my car in an unmarked vehicle, like a luxury van. So I had asked Samantha to pull over. I was taking my kids to a birthday party. And, you know, I don't know what's going on. Watford is very, very violent. I don't know who it is. And I tell her to go into the house, and I fled. So I was not arrested for, let's say, maybe a week later. So the whole time I'm watching this play out on the news, and, you know, it's just mind blowing. You know, that's the best way to put it, because it's very surreal. It doesn't seem real, but you're living it.
And so Patrick was on the run, later stating he was terrified of the police. Meanwhile, detectives began interrogating his girlfriend back at the police station. Samantha initially implicated Patrick in Andy's murder, but at the 1994 trial, she recanted what she had told the police and a grand jury, saying officers had coerced the statement from her by threatening to take away her children. She later said detectives interrogated her for more than 10 hours. Back at Samantha and Patrick's apartment, police said they found a 9mm Taurus, as well as a pullover-style black hooded sweatshirt, black jeans, and black combat boots. After about a week on the run, someone who was going to give Patrick a ride out of town reported his whereabouts to police. Police swarmed a low-income housing project where they were told Patrick was hiding. An officer spotted him under the ramp of an abandoned building, according to court records.
And the officer saw the reflection of my glasses. And, he saw the reflection, and he just pulled me out. And there was a crowd of people in the project. One person said, uh-oh, back to Stateville, homie.
Stateville Correctional Center is the maximum security prison where Patrick would be locked up for the next 24 years. Patrick said he was depressed those first days of his life sentence and had chronic headaches. He thought about everything in his life that had led up to this point, his tumultuous childhood in Elgin with a mother who never accepted him, the abusive, alcoholic boyfriend she brought home, his biological father's mental breakdown triggered by the death of Patrick's grandmother. Patrick last saw his father while he was living in a boarding house, around the time Patrick was 13 or 14, and shortly before his mother gave custody of him to the state. It would be the last time he saw his father, who died while Patrick was incarcerated. Until this day, he hasn't been able to find where his father is buried or learn how he died. Patrick was a dysfunctional child by his own admission, and his mother, who had lived with cerebral palsy, didn't want to raise him. They never really bonded, Patrick said. After she gave him up at 14, Patrick was shuffled through more than a dozen foster homes or state facilities. In contrast to his mother, Patrick remembers his father fondly, even though he never got to know him very well. He recalls playing football with him inside the house and called him a big old kid. He remembers his father loved Star Trek and partly credits him for his self-proclaimed nerdiness and bookishness. He said those traits saved him in his quest to get out.
I knew that I had to learn law. I knew that I had to have what they call a jailhouse hustle, right? I knew I had to support myself. And, by the grace of the Creator, I was one of those guys, not early on, but later, able to send money to my kids, able to have a bank account, able to support myself by jailhouse lawyering.
In 1996, when it came time to file his post-conviction appeal, Patrick had taught himself enough about the law to have an active role with the brief his state-appointed attorney would file. Remember those photographs Patrick's defense expert took? The photos were somehow missing from the appellate record now. Patrick told his attorney to find them, make them part of the record, and use them to argue that he was innocent. He also asked that his lawyer send him the brief before he filed it. His attorney did send Patrick the brief after he had already filed it. He told Patrick he was right. The photos were missing, but he found them. However, he said he didn't make them part of the record and just used them for his own reference before returning them to the state's attorney's office. Patrick would need a court order to get the photos back.
When I read that, right, I can't even tell you, like, whose side are you on? Like, what, you know, how much more blatant? How could you be a lawyer and your defendant tells you there's photographic evidence show the bullets don't match? They're missing from the appellate record. They were supposed to be transmitted on appeal as per Supreme Court Rule 325, 324, et cetera, right? This is ABC law. This is rudimentary law. And he doesn't get them and then doesn't even give me a copy. And, you know what I mean? It tells me all the way I'm going to get them with the court order. So that was my direct appeal.
Patrick was on his own now, so he was sending 20 letters a week to law offices asking for representation, once jamming the mail machine with what he called his underground stapler. While he was lucky to get a response, it was a no. Some never wrote back, and some of the letters were returned as undeliverable because the law directory at Stateville was outdated. Patrick filed a grievance to get an updated copy. While he waited for someone to represent him, Patrick continued filing his appeals, covering as much ground as possible. He said he wanted the legal system to know he wasn't going away.
I had filed probably 2-3 post-conviction petitions. I had filed, you know, habeas corpus. I filed everything plus some mandamuses. You know, by 2007, I learned administrative law because I got a grant and used that to take correspondence classes in law.
Sometime in 2000, Patrick saw a newspaper article about the Integrated Ballistic Identification System, software that allows investigators to analyze high-resolution, multidimensional images of shell casings to find the unique markings that link them to a specific weapon. The images from IBIS are stored in the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network, or NIBIN, managed by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or ATF. At the time, this system was still in its infancy, but since 1999, close to 3 million images have been entered into the NIBIN database, according to the ATF, helping law enforcement identify suspects in countless homicides. Patrick filed another appeal after reading the article, asking that the evidence in his case be retested using IBIS. His appeal was rejected, but Patrick said they did give him a breadcrumb, as he put it.
They said, you know, we can't give you the gun testing because the law doesn't allow it. The law would have to be changed. So that little caveat sent me on this odyssey to actually change the law in Illinois.
Patrick started writing legislators, asking that they update the state's post-conviction statute to allow for IBIS testing, just like the statute was once updated to allow DNA testing in appeals. IBIS was primarily being used as a tool to identify suspects, but Patrick thought it should also be used to exculpate people. He rarely got any answers.
In that time, first, I started out writing legislators. Once again, I'm just some Joe Schmo in jail.
Patrick continued with his appeals and scored a crucial victory when an appellate court ordered that the gun and shell casings used as evidence to convict him had to be preserved. Had that not happened, Patrick wouldn't have gotten another chance to test the evidence.
And I can't tell you how many nightmares I had about the disposing of the gun. I have like imagery in my head right now of like prosecutors with like a lantern and a canoe, you know, wrapping in lambskin and throwing it in the Rock River in the middle of night, you know, in foggy night. right? That's how ridiculous, you know, my imagination ran with this. Like, they're going to destroy the gun. They're going to lose the gun. They're going to hide the gun, right? Because, you know, preservation of evidence is not absolute. So they ordered the gun and the bullets had to be held by Rossi.
As for getting the law changed so he could test it, well, that took a bit of kismet to finally happen. In 2006, Patrick wrote a short article for a prison newsletter called Stateville Speaks, run by Bill Ryan, a longtime inmates advocate. In the article, Patrick talked about his case and argued that laws should be updated to keep up with technological advances. In the letter he sent Ryan to publish his article, Patrick also asked that he show it to lawmakers, hoping that one of them would be compelled to run a bill. At the time, Ryan happened to be serving on a criminal justice committee at the state capitol in Springfield. Patrick recalls Ryan telling him how he got his letter.
You know, he's a big guy, you know, almost look like Santa Claus, right? You know, and he's like, I had a table full of mail. And I just reached in the stack and pulled out your letter. And you asked me to take your idea to Springfield. And he did.
That eventually did the trick. In 2007, lawmakers updated what is allowed in post-conviction proceedings. It was a simple addition of a few lines to an existing statute, and it passed with little notice. Remarkable, considering Illinois was, and continues to be, the only state in the country that allows IBIS testing on appeal. Even with IBIS on the law books, however, it took another 4 years for Patrick to get an appellate court to grant his request to retest the ballistic evidence in his case. But after waiting 15 years for a law firm to take up his case, he now had a team of the brightest legal minds in Chicago behind him. The law firm Jenner and Block and Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions began to represent him for free, taking an interest in Patrick's story and the unique nature of his appeal. Then, in 2011, an Illinois appellate court finally said Patrick had a right to have his evidence retested because lawmakers had updated state law. Patrick remembers that as the big turning point in his case.
I knew in my heart, I already knew what the results were going to come back to. What I knew never really mattered. It was getting other people to understand it and believe it.
Patrick was the first person in the country to request IBIS testing on appeal, and that complicated court proceedings over how to do the gun testing. Over the next 2 years, three forensics experts from the Illinois State Police, including Daniel Gunnell from the first trial, retested the shell casings from 1993. The three state forensics experts reached conflicting and sometimes unclear conclusions. One examiner said he found matches to both cartridge cases and one of the bullets, but the results from the second bullet were inconclusive. Meanwhile, two other state experts, including Gunnell, concluded that both bullets were inconclusive, but found matches with the two cartridges. Patrick's attorneys hired two experts to analyze the evidence independently, without being told which case it was for. They both concluded definitively that the cartridge cases and bullets from the crime scene did not come from the gun Rockford police had found. But Patrick's case was far from over, and he was still in prison indefinitely. On December 13, 2016, during an evidentiary hearing on Patrick's motion for a new trial, Gunnell took the stand. This time, he was far less sure of the conclusions he made in 1994. He said he would no longer say a particular gun was a match for a crime to the exclusion of all firearms, acknowledging that the language is inaccurate and can give listeners an inappropriate perception. Gunnell's reversal reflected how far the science behind ballistic analysis had come since 1994. Even with IBIS, someone still must analyze high-confidence matches under a microscope. And courts now limit or bar the type of testimony Gunnell gave in 1994 because it can mislead jurors. The judge also heard from the two defense experts who had analyzed the ballistic evidence, John Murdoch and Chris Coleman, two of the most respected firearm tool mark examiners in the country. On March 3, 2017, almost 24 years after Andy Asher was murdered, a judge in Winnebago County was set to rule whether the case should be tried again. Besides the new ballistic evidence, Patrick's lawyers wanted to present an alternative suspect theory to increase the chances of getting a second trial. Patrick didn't think that was necessary.
I never agreed. Like, I didn't want to go with the alternative suspect. You know what I'm saying? Like, I felt that the ballistics was enough. So my lawyers, they were, you know, not happy, to say the least. You know, in the back room, you can imagine that conversation, even though some were on my side.
The judge asked Patrick if he was sure of his decision and why he was making it. "I would like to rest on the strength of what we have," Patrick said, according to court records. "I believe this is it.
I don't feel that I need anything else. I feel that the ballistics is enough." And so he went into the back. He said, "Well, I'll issue my ruling." So he went to the back for like 15 minutes, and it seemed like 15 years. And when he came out, he awarded the new trial. And so, I mean, elation, you know, I obviously I was elated. I think some people were stunned.
He wasn't immediately set free, though. He had to make a $50,000 bond. And in the meantime, he would be transferred from Stateville back to county jail in Winnebago County. His nightmare was far from over.
They take me to the county, and because I'm coming from Stateville, they put me in Max. And Max is basically you're on lockdown 23 hours a day, you're on tier. You know, the first day I arrived, someone got knocked out, you know, at breakfast.
Then on April 27th, almost 2 months after a new trial was ordered, Patrick stepped out of the Winnebago County Justice Center as a free man for the first time in 23 years. He was 51 years old. Among the people greeting him outside was Michelle Carr, Patrick's fiance. They had met as prison pen pals in 2011. It was Carr, along with family and friends, who raised the $5,000 needed to satisfy the bond. Patrick called it a momentous day. But Winnebago County wasn't done with Patrick just yet, however. As part of the conditions for his release, Patrick had to live in Rockford, and he had a curfew of 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day. He couldn't have a cell phone or use social media.
At every juncture, like, look, you had 5 rounds of the gun testing. You got, you know, the state's experts all contradicting themselves, contradicting what was said prior, right? You got IBIS, shows no match. You know, like, so you're happy, but at the same time, I was upset.
Patrick said all the restrictions rubbed him the wrong way. He felt that, even though he had not been acquitted yet, he had made a strong enough case for his innocence that there should be less restrictions on his release. At the same time, Patrick had trouble adjusting to being back in the world after being locked up for almost a quarter century. In prison, he had become a sort of celebrity, with inmates seeking him out to help on their cases.
I guess in my head, I really had all these ideas of what I was going to do and implement. And I was really, you know, and going back to the county, right? You know, it's like all these guys with like no experience in law and all this. So it's almost like, it's like bullpen Jesus, right? So everybody's like trying to talk to you about your case everywhere you go and ask you questions about their, you know, like how to help them. But when you get out, You're back to being a nobody. You know what I mean? Actually, you're almost less than a nobody because, like, some of the requirements is, like, you have to have a job. Well, I was thankful. Michelle, you know, she had a cleaning company, and I worked for that, but I still had to go look for work, you know, because it's a requirement. It was So getting out, my first probably almost 2 days straight, I didn't sleep.
Patrick sometimes worked for Michelle's cleaning business, but he couldn't join her when she went to Champaign for work because he had to get permission from the court first.
Getting out, you know, it's like you have all this ambition and all this energy and you want to do this and you want to establish that, but you're still very much still locked up.
He found a job working on home improvement projects, but hurt his back after a month and couldn't return to work. He would need back surgery. And although he was getting a taste of life outside prison walls, prosecutors were still working behind the scenes in an effort to make that short-lived. Coloring your hair in the comfort of your own home is pretty great, but you might be wondering how you would ever find the right color, and then what about the cost? Well, Madison Reed makes coloring your hair at home affordable, and they give you the tools you need to choose your perfect color. Madison Reed takes coloring your hair at home to the next level and gives you beautiful professional hair color delivered right to your door, starting at just $22. For decades, there were only two options for coloring your hair. You could either try outdated at-home color or spend time and money at a salon, but not anymore. Madison Reed's color is unique. It's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. And finding the perfect shade is pretty easy. You just go to their website, madison-reed.com, and take their quick online quiz that will ask you all sorts of questions about your hair. Then they match you with your perfect shade. So you can do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. Now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. Last year, there was a victim of identity theft every 3 seconds. A criminal could be spending your money, applying for loans in your name, damaging your credit, or even selling your personal info on the dark web. Unfortunately, you could miss certain threats to your identity by just checking bank statements and monitoring your credit. The solution? LifeLock Identity Theft Protection. LifeLock sees certain threats you could miss if you're only monitoring your credit, and it'll alert you if they find something that could be suspicious. Plus, if you become a victim of identity theft, a U.S.-based identity restoration specialist dedicated to your case will work to fix it from start to finish. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock by Norton can help protect your personal information so you can keep what's yours. Save up to 25% off your first year. Go to LifeLock.com/court. That's LifeLock.com/court for 25% off. It would be almost 2 years before Patrick's second trial, as prosecutors fought to overturn the ruling for a new trial. During that time, Patrick was sent to jail twice for a combined 110 days for smoking marijuana and using some prescription painkillers Michelle had.
They're really taking each pretrial violation as like, you're out here committing felonies and, you know, throwing stones at the prison. But in reality, I just want to be free.
The second time he was locked up, he and Michelle lost their apartment. Patrick's name wasn't on the lease, but the landlord was fine with that, as long as there weren't any complaints. But then the local news broke that Patrick Pursley, the man who had been awarded a second trial for a murder he insisted he didn't commit, was back in jail for failing drug tests. Patrick was on the phone with Michelle when she got her 5-day eviction notice. In all, it would cost them $3,000 to move to a new place. Patrick said he was embarrassed to be back in jail because it undermined the positive work he was trying to do in the community. Since his release from prison, he organized fundraising events for at-risk youth in Rockford, with his nonprofit called I Am Kid Culture. It was a continuation of the work he had started in prison when he wrote a children's book titled The Adventures of Kid Culture and the World Explores, Volume 1. It was for children with incarcerated parents who had faced some of the same issues Patrick had growing up.
Me being a ward of the state where I was coming up and seeing just how little resources there are on like west side of Rockford, you're dealing with like 40 blocks of blight and gang activity. You know what I'm saying? So I understand like you can't save everybody, but you don't know who you will reach and who you won't reach. So I feel very much that telling my story, helping kids understand like their own PTSD symptoms, you know, you being a child being raised in a place where they're shooting 2-3 times a week, you know, that type of situation, you know, but also to get them to understand their value and to value their future.
On November 2019, with the second trial just days away, a stunning revelation from prosecutors suggested the case against Patrick might have been deeply flawed all along. Back on April 14th, 2017, the day of the hearing to release Patrick on bond, Andy Asher's mother told a victim's advocate with the state's attorney's office that after Patrick was convicted in 1994, a Rockford police detective told her they never found the weapon used in Andy's murder. The gun entered into evidence had been planted, the detective said, according to Lois Asher. The victim's advocate relayed the conversation to Assistant State's Attorney Stephen Biaggi, the lead prosecutor in the second trial, and then he and his boss directed the victim's advocate to write a bystander report to give to Rockford police to investigate. But nothing was ever done about it. Biaggi was fired in June 2018 for reasons unrelated to Patrick's case, and the prosecutor who took over the case, Assistant Deputy State's Attorney James Brune, couldn't locate the bystander report with the trial just days away. When all of this came out, Patrick was furious, considering prosecutors had known this even as they were trying to stop a second trial. Prosecutors would also give contradictory statements later about why the information was not immediately relayed to Patrick's defense attorneys.
So not only are you subjecting me to this pretrial hell, but you're actually using taxpayer money to go and file an appeal that you have no faith in.
The judge ordered an investigation, and police and prosecutors had to turn over all paper and electronic records that mentioned Patrick's case. Patrick's attorneys filed a motion to dismiss the case, citing the prosecutor's failure to disclose significant exculpatory evidence.
You know, we have actual, text messages from a former prosecutor that's like, oh my God, I knew this case was going to come back and get me. You know, Patrick Percy is innocent, you know, sarcastically, and went and got some big city lawyers.
Patrick's trial was moved to January 10th, and the bystander report was eventually located. But prior to that, the state's attorney's office sent an investigator to talk to Lois Asher about her conversation with the victim's advocate in 2017. The report the investigator subsequently wrote was similar to that of the victim's advocate. But during a 2-day hearing in December on the motion to dismiss, Lois Asher gave sworn testimony denying having that conversation with a police detective. She said it was her now deceased husband who was told by a detective that police had planted the gun. Judge Joseph McGraw, who was presiding over the second trial, rejected the defense's motion to dismiss, saying Lois Asher's sworn testimony refuted or denied her prior statements. Although he called her testimony perplexing, he concluded that her prior statement was uncorroborated hearsay and not exculpatory evidence. Although his case was not dismissed, the recent revelations prompted Judge McGraw to remove all the pre-trial restrictions that Patrick was under. Patrick and Michelle moved to Champaign, more than 2.5 hours away, because he felt uneasy in Rockford. He said every morning before court hearings, he was seeing unmarked police vehicles near his house. For the second trial, Patrick opted to have Judge McGraw decide the case instead of a jury.
Being Rockford being the way it is, I kind of understood, like, it's better this judge, he's a law judge. He's not a politics judge. And if you get a bunch of jurors that's more of a conservative bent, I might be going back to prison.
After a 3-day bench trial, which included testimony from forensic experts on each side, Judge McGraw was ready to deliver a verdict. For Patrick, it was like going back in time.
You know, it's very much like your chair is back sitting on this like edge of hell again, and someone could just walk up and just tip your chair over, and you're back in Stateville for the rest of your life.
It was soon clear which way Judge McGraw was leaning, as he started going through evidence and testimony in the case that didn't add up. He didn't just focus on the ballistics testing. He also had concerns about the other evidence presented against Patrick, including the clothing investigators had retrieved from Patrick's house. Here's what he said. There were variances between the clothing that was identified by the eyewitnesses and the testable clothing seized pursuant to the search warrant. Additionally, the clothing that was seized pursuant to the search warrant from the defendant was subjected to forensic testing to determine if there was any other biological evidence on that clothing, and no biological evidence was found on the clothing that was collected from the defendant, nor was a correlation established between the shoes and the footprints that were in the snow at or near the scene of the crime.
When he actually read the verdict, I was as body numb as I was when I found guilty.
Judge McGraw went on to say that witness descriptions of the assailant, quote, were at odds with the physical description of the defendant.
And the judge, he basically had seen these exact same things, right? Direction of travel, the type of clothing, footwear, et cetera, eyewitness, right, that says I'm not the person. You know, so I felt very vindicated because a lot of lawyers couldn't hear me talking about these other issues. They only want to focus on, you know, the gun.
Then Judge McGraw said he wanted to speak at length about the firearm and tool mark evidence. Quote, without getting into all the minutia of their observations and conclusions, there are some things that I think are helpful for all of us to consider. If you go back to the 1993 testimony of Mr. Gunnell, and the documentation that was created in support of his conclusion that the bullet fired from the Taurus was fired from the Taurus to the exclusion of all other firearms in the world, or all other handguns, or all other 9mm, I mean, it was an absolute categorical conclusion with no equivocation. His notes and his records are scant, were scant. The reasons for the conclusion were not well documented or documented at all. There were no drawings or sketches or photographs. Now, admittedly, we're talking about 1993. Judge McGraw also said the defense's experts were more thorough when they examined the evidence and reached the conclusion that the gun police entered into evidence was not the murder weapon. Quote, Mr. Murdoch and Mr. Coleman considered things that the state police didn't consider, such as the ejector marks and extractor marks and the magazine feed lip marks. I think the way to think about this is that it's almost like there is a puzzle, and all the pieces have to fit together in order for a conclusion to be reached. And if there isn't sufficient agreement of significant individual features, then you can't reach a conclusion that it's inconclusive or it's eliminated. And Mr. Murdoch and Mr. Coleman compared all the relevant markings on the cartridge cases, including the breech face marks, the firing pin impressions, marks on the firing pin, ejector marks and extractor marks, magazine lip marks, and they documented everything. Judge McGraw concluded by saying, the court finds that the state has not met its burden of proving Mr. Pursley's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and enters a judgment of acquittal. The court erupted in applause as Patrick hugged his attorneys and other supporters. After the ruling, Winnebago County State's Attorney Marilyn Height Ross said in a statement, quote, "In this case, the court found that the evidence presented by the state at the retrial did not rise to the level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We respect the court's decision." Patrick is now suing the City of Rockford Police and forensic scientists at the Illinois State Police Crime Lab, alleging they fabricated evidence to get a conviction. In February 2021, Judge McGraw granted Patrick the certificate of innocence he requested. Not only does a certificate make him eligible for financial benefits, it also improves his standing in his civil suit against police. Rockford Police and the Illinois Police, for their part, continue to insist Patrick is guilty. Recently, a group of the officers who are being sued, as well as the estates of officers involved in the case who are now deceased, filed a motion asking Judge McGraw to reconsider the certificate of innocence he awarded Patrick. They argue the ballistic evidence in the case was never properly tested with IBIS because of a formatting error. In their motion, they contend the Illinois State Police recently retested the evidence with IBIS, properly this time, and found that the shell casings from the 1993 crime scene and the gun police seized, quote, "are associated with one another." Such results in IBIS are not unusual, though, according to Ashley Waddell Tingstad, an attorney who worked on Patrick's criminal case and who is now one of the lawyers representing him in his civil suit. She said IBIS sometimes provides scores of possible matches, but they still have to be examined and verified by a ballistics expert.
Their defense, of course, is that we didn't do anything wrong and Patrick's guilty. So, you know, we're again, in essence, litigating his innocence.
In Patrick's acquittal, Judge McGraw noted that sometimes there are similarities between sets of cartridge casings that give the impression they came from the same gun. But, he added, when all the relevant markings are considered under the varying levels of microscopic examination, varying lighting from different perspectives, it is demonstrated conclusively that the evidentiary shell casings were not fired from the 9mm Taurus that was collected from Miss Crabtree when the search warrant was executed. Andy Asher's family still believes Patrick is guilty. His sister, Jill, told the Rockford Register-Star in 2017 that she thinks Patrick is a con man. For his part, Patrick says he harbors no anger or ill will against Andy Asher's family.
You know, the family gets all respect. I'm not even mad, you know, the mother didn't come forward for 24 years with what the detectives told her. She wasn't trying to help me get out when she made those revelations. And for whatever reason, they sold it to her and they can't look at the evidence and see it for what it is. You know, I'll forever be a villain in their head, but they're not for me because they experienced a heavy loss, lose a son in their 20s. You know, that's a heavy loss.
And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Ivan Moreno. Ivan is a Chicago-based freelance journalist, and you can read more of his work on ivanmorenowriter.com. And to read more about what Patrick Pursley is up to, check out his website at iamkidculture.org. To hear these episodes without the ads and to hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, go to courtjunkie.com/support, which will redirect you to my Patreon page. Thanks again for listening. Until next time. I know I've told you guys before about the Jordan Harbinger Show. It's a podcast I think you really should be listening to. And I'm not kidding when I say that court junkies will especially love it. Jordan's show, which Apple named one of its best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and then come to your own conclusions about what's happening, even inside your own brain. Each episode is a conversation with a different fascinating guest, and there is something for everyone here. In one episode, Jordan talks to a hostage negotiator from the FBI who offers techniques on how to get people to like and trust you. Another episode tells the story of a cinematographer who discovered a lost city in the jungle and made one of the most important archaeological finds of the century. One of his more recent episodes was with Bruce Sackman, a renowned investigator who tracks down serial killers. Another was with Leah Remini, who talked about surviving Hollywood and Scientology. I really enjoy this show, and I think you will as well. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.